Welcome to Committing Faith in Public. This is the podcast for people who want to be inspired by individuals and communities of faith doing good work in public. Our guests tell stories of their work of weaving a more just, kind, and diversity-inclusive society. Our starting place for stories is Oklahoma because that is where we live, and because many people, both in Oklahoma and beyond, are surprised when they learn that interreligious friendly, pro-democracy, diversity welcoming, public good-oriented religion even exists in Oklahoma. So through this podcast, we're spreading good news and encouraging you in your faith and public life work. I'm Gary Peluso-Verden, President Emeritus at Phillips Theological Seminary in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and working on the Religion and Public Life Initiative for the seminary. I'm in the office of the Reverend Dr. George Young, who's state senator for, is it District 48?
Senate District 48
here in Oklahoma. And George, I've had the pleasure of knowing you, I think, since the late 1990s.
Yes.
When you were still an MDiv student, I think.
That's right.
Just finishing. And then when I came back to the seminary in 2005, after being away for about 5 years, you were a trustee.
I was a trustee.
And yeah. You were finishing your Doctor of Ministry.
That's exactly right.
A program. It's been a joy working with you and getting to know you and counting you amongst my community friends for now a long time.
It has been a while.
Yeah. So thanks for taking some time to sit down with me today.
My pleasure.
Yeah. So for people who may not know you, a little bit about your vocational background. I think you didn't start in ministry, right? You had a career before ministry.
I did. My undergraduate degree was in accounting. I loved accounting. High school record keeping when that opened up, and well, I'll be honest with you, I probably went into the first record keeping class because I saw there was a lot of girls going in there. But I kind of fell in love with accounting. I really did, and bought that thing. It is the language of business, and so I got deeply involved in it. Went to college. Playing basketball was above learning, but I did get something from it. I majored in accounting and never changed my major. And when I graduated from college, I don't talk about this much, but I worked at one of the few. It probably was less than five African American certified public accounting firms in existence in the whole nation in 1975-76 when I graduated.
And where was that?
Memphis, Tennessee. Oh, yeah. Born and raised in Memphis. Went to school in Jackson, Tennessee, but Memphis, Tennessee. And so one of those firms were in Memphis. And so, and it was a time when accounting was taking off. Everybody needed accountants. The FBI was even trying to interview me because they needed more minorities and needed more minorities in accounting. And it was just an interesting time that a lot of things opened up because of being in accounting at that time. And that's really where I started. But yeah, to backtrack, you said vocation, so I had to backtrack. When I was about 13, I will assure you and will always believe that I received my calling in ministry at one of those events that we used to call the summer revivals. And I not only felt the presence of God, but I actually heard the voice of God telling me that that's where I want you to be. I'm looking up at the pulpit and the ministers who were there, and just never told him about it. It was nine of us in our family, and I never told my father and mother, were both deeply involved in the church, active. I mean, my father was like, the deacons who run the church. Pastor would come to our house before he did anything, you know. And my mother was on what we call a mother board, which was a leading organization for the women. And I never told him about it. And I was like 13 years old, and I didn't acknowledge my calling until I turned 29. Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. So it was a long journey. I ran. Nobody in my family, my family had been in ministry, and we were church people who went to church all the time, religious folk, and all of that. And I don't know if I was actually frightened as much as I was thinking I had enough sense to know this is probably a big deal. You know? And I want to be an accountant. Mm-hmm. I want to be a CPA. Yeah, I want to make some good money. You know, I want to. That's what I want to do. And so, to me, that would interfere with my striving to be one of the best accountants in the world. I really love accounting, man. Yeah, it was just very special. Still is to this day. Yeah.
Then you made a transition from accounting to that very similar field, ministry.
right. It was just a path. Yeah, a direct path. Yeah. No, to be honest, Gary, that's an interesting story because I worked at that accounting firm. Taught a little accounting at a business college for a while in Memphis, but then Kraft Food Service hired me on in a trainee program, became accounting office manager in Memphis, transferred me to California. I was accounting office manager there. We opened a big plant. They had started a new computer system, and I was on the ground floor learning all that, so I did some traveling for them. Then they had some problems in Oklahoma City with the office, and they sent me here to kind of help the accounting manager here. Plus, you know, at that point, probably early 80s, in it had retail and the restaurant side. Probably in the restaurant side of Kraft Food Service then, which was not bought up and sold 20 times at that point. I was probably the second or third, at 27, 28 years old, second or third highest ranking African American. Wow. Kraft. And they were really nice to me. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm trying mm-hmm. to do a good job because mm-hmm. I liked it. And so got here. They wanted to transfer me again around the same time, early 80s. And my father was ill. This is the closest I've been to Memphis. I could jump on I-40 and get there in 7 hours. And when they got ready to move me again, I decided I would stay in Oklahoma City. I liked it. I thought it was growing. This was... early 80s. It's not like it is now.
Right.
But
right.
I could tell that, you know, it was, I didn't want to go back to Memphis because I'd get lost in that crowd. You know, this is a crowd that, you know, I really thought that I could, you know, this is something I can do something with mm-hmm. here in Oklahoma City mm-hmm. because it looks like a lot of things are going on and happening. And so I stayed. But around that same time, well, the other thing that happened is, you have some crashes in life, and I had a crash in life. My marriage was breaking up, you know, just crashing, man. And being that young and trying to feel life, I started back to going to church because I'd gotten out here. And it was the pastor at the church I started. Matter of fact, I met a friend from Tennessee who invited me to his church, and that's where I really went. The other part of the story, I met a friend at a bar. Mm-hmm. Met a friend at a bar in Oklahoma City when I had just moved here. And he was from Covington, Tennessee, which is right outside of Memphis. And his words to me were, when we got to talking, you know, we found out that we knew a few folk there. He said, "I got someone at church I want you to meet." Yeah, I said, "Well, yeah, you know, no." And that was Thelma. That was Thelma. And so that was the beginning of that. And it kind of, and so I said it because meeting her kind of pulled me back into the lane that I should have been in all the time. And really, before we got married, it was really our friendship, that Thelma's friendship and with me, that helped me to kind of stop for a minute so that I could hear God all over again. Mm-hmm. And because of her and that relationship, mm-hmm. before we got married, I mean, we were friends working together. She was like a youth minister. I was a youth minister. She was youth director. I started then getting reattached to my spiritual being, and once you open that door, it's over. And man, when I started thinking about it again, that whole flood of memories of, you do know that I've called you for something else, that you do know that I'm still waiting on you. You do know the time is running out. You do know you need to make this decision. And I acknowledged my call at ministry, man, and I tell you, from there, it I will never regret it. I will never regret it.
And you had then 30 years in the pastorate.
From that point, 30 years in the pastor. Started off in the clinical pastoral education. I was assistant minister at the church. Started off in CPE at really right over here at Presbyterian mm-hmm. Hospital, which is now the University of Oklahoma Health Science Center. Started over there, did the first year CPE program, and then they had advanced CPE.
Right.
I was one of the first second year students to go into the advanced CPE program, and then did the second residency down at VA and Children's Hospital. Loved chaplaincy. I just fell in love with it. About that same time is when I got feelings about a small church in Boley, Oklahoma. Boley, Oklahoma, and went down, knew some of the family down uh-huh. there from the church I was presently in. Man, went down there, and they called me, and that was my First Church, it was such a pleasure to get the history of that town.
For those who are listening who may not know, Boley is one of the historic black towns.
Oh, black towns, that's right. Right. The railroad was coming through at every so many miles. I don't know how many, it was 10 miles or something. They had to have water stops for some reason. And Boley was one of those towns. And Boley is probably the most prestigious of all those towns. It's still in existence, lost up, but it had cotton gins, hospital, bank, owned utilities. I mean, Boley was a thriving. This started in 1903, I believe, when they were established. Mm. So it was before statehood.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Man, it was really the history of that town and the African American population. It was, I do believe, I'm pretty safe saying it had the largest population of any African American town in Oklahoma at that time. So it was a lot of history there. But
right.
I mean, it had gone. By the time I got there in 90, it was, you know, it was not that anymore, but
sure.
It was still, you know, had a school. At that point, it still had a school, and the prison there had a prison there that was part of the economic engine there. But so that's why I ended up, my first church was in Boulder, Oklahoma.
Yeah, what was your first congregation in Oklahoma City area?
Holy Temple Baptist
Holy
Church.
Temple, of course.
Holy Temple Baptist Church, yeah, because I started preaching at Faith Memorial is where I mm-hmm. started my ministry. Then the first church I pastored was Antioch and Boley, and then the first church in it was only two, the second was Holy Temple in Oklahoma City, yeah.
And then you were there for how long?
I was 15 years. I was both about the same at the time,
okay.
15 years, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Obviously, Antioch was a small church. We had probably 60, 70 folks. And when I got here, 120, 130 folks at Holy Temple.
Mm-hmm.
But, man, it was I enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it, even with, you know, the problems of pastoring. I enjoyed it because I was able to do some really, really, I thought, wonderful things. I look back on it, you know, we built that 50-unit independent living senior housing
right.
back there. We
right.
had
which was a private public.
That was a private. That's right. That's right. That's right. And it was something that was needed in that community. They had nursing homes, but they did not have any place where, as people were growing older but staying healthier,
mm-hmm.
That they could go and have a nice place to live. And so I'm still very excited about that.
Mm-hmm.
I drive by it whenever mm-hmm. I get down. I drive by mm-hmm. Temple Gardens just to see it and mm-hmm. see because that was a. I mean, the other side of that was. It was, because they were telling me we'd need about $5 million and, you know, we couldn't get it. And I bet you I tried for 5 years to find ways of doing that. Once the idea was given to me, we finally did through a public partnership with the Oklahoma Housing Authority and tax credits. But we got it. But I'm going to tell you, it was one of those things that reinstalled in me this idea mm-hmm. that there really is a God who really is able to help accomplish some things that if you just try.
Mm-hmm.
And because there was no way, I had people telling me, you're crazy to do that. You can't, you know, that, how you, where you come with that money? How you going to get it? And it took 5 years, but we got it. And I can remember going out there when they laid that first foundation and getting down on my knees and just thanking God because it was miraculous in
mm-hmm.
my mind, you know. And so mm-hmm. it still exists. Still, I think, one of the foundations in that community. And help start, to help other folks start thinking about it, and they build a couple of other facilities like that since then. So, yeah, that was a big thing. The other big thing was the connection with First Christian out in Edmond.
Yes, right.
Man, we did back-to-school block parties where we gave 5,000 packs of school supplies away. I had a great relationship with that church.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I still see folk now who talk about how that helped them to see things differently. We exchanged Martin Luther King programs, in addition to some other stuff, Sunday school program. But we would go out there one year, and then they would come to us the
mm-hmm.
next year. And so
mm-hmm.
They always respected us, which was the other thing. We didn't, you know, much larger church.
Yes, right, much larger.
Yeah, much
yep.
larger. But they always respected our contribution to the relationship, which I thought was ultimately important for me and my congregation. And the first Wiz mm-hmm. Kids program in Northeast Oklahoma City was at Holy Temple, but it was in connection with First Christian in Edmond and so on.
And how many years did that relationship go on? Do you remember about how many?
Probably about 5 years until I retired.
And then after your pastorate, after you retired from that
right.
part of...
I flunked retirement, right.
Right. Yeah. Then you went on and you were elected first to the state, the House of Representatives.
Right. Yeah, that was interesting because your Coburn announced his medical diagnosis, and he was not going to run again. So both my state representative and my state senator decided to run for other things, and I'd been involved in the party work, Democratic Party, and so people started saying, well, you know, you ought to run, you ought to run, and and Thelma said, you ought to run, and so we cast our lot that very next year after I retired in 2013. We made the decision in 2014 to run, really right before the filing date, to be honest with you. The month before I had to make the decision to officially enter that race was the month that Thelma received her diagnosis of stage 4 lung cancer. And it was, I had decided not to run. And she said to me, matter of fact, this is the other crazy part. We had driven to her home in Alabama to bury her sister who had died of lung cancer. And up to that point, she had three brothers that died. I'd done all those funerals. They asked her to do her sister's funeral in light of her diagnosis. It, obviously, it was great, because Demo was great, but it was great. But on the way back, I was telling her, you know, we were driving from there all the way back to Oklahoma City. We were in Arkansas, and I remember, and I said to her, I decided I'm not going to run because I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know what's going to happen with you, and I want to be there for you. And you know, we'd had the depreciation already, where the shock and all that. It was traumatic. It was shattering. It really was. But you know, we'd kind of adjusted. She had started fighting, and so that pulled, sucked me into the fight. So, but on the way back, and I remember when she, in response to that, she said to me, "You're trying to make your decision on what might be. I need you, for my sake, to make the decision on what is right now. And right now, I feel good enough to go through that." And it just...
And that was it.
I couldn't back out then, you know. So I signed the next... It may have been even the next week that I had to sign. And we got back and I signed. And we had a tough... That was the toughest race, was the first one. After that, they hadn't been as tough. I'll be honest with you, they hadn't been as tough. And so... We did that, served two terms over there, the senator left, and I ran for the Senate position, and here we are.
So I'm real curious. I once read a historian and ethicist who said that pastors and politicians have a very similar kind of authority that they have, which is persuasive authority, that you always have to woo and massage a constituency. And I'm real curious about the transition from pastorate to legislator and politician, and what translated well. And, you know, they felt well prepared because of, you know, there's politics in church. We all know that. Because there's people. Because there's people, there's shared power, and there's politics. So I'm curious in ways that your experience in the pastorate helped prepare you for the work you're doing now. In other ways that the work as a legislator or a senator is really different from anything that you had.
First off, that is a true statement. I tell folk all the time that I could not have chosen a better field to have preceded me going in politics. That's just a fact. Because as a pastor, I tell folk all the time, I sit in my office and a lot of the things, 60, 75% of the things that people come into my office to talk to me about, you could take us, that person and me, and just transpose us over to my church office at Holy Temple, and it would be the same conversation. So it is. Now, the other side of it, you're right. As a pastor, you know, you stand up on Sunday mornings and stop what you're doing. Everybody look at me and listen to me, because I've got something to tell you. And so it's the same thing in politics. I thought it was a great transition for me. It prepared me well. You stand up in front of folks, talking to them, trying not only to sway them one way or the other, but to inform them. My job as a pastor was to take the headlines and interpret them through the lens of Scripture. My job as a legislator is to take the headlines and try to interpret them through the lens of what I believe is the best forward path for us. So I think it's very connected. And that translated very well, all of those skills that I used for pastoring. What didn't work very well was the running into the thing that in politics, there's always somebody else who has more power. I'm not positioned, it's just what, there's always somebody else. And so you have to now work with a group of people who are, in essence, on the same level as you, which is really unlike being in the church, because as a pastor, you know, you, and especially in the African-American Baptist tradition, I had some leeway. I had last word.
Right.
You know,
right.
Although I had all the weight on my shoulders, I had last word. Where in politics, I don't. You know, not only have I got to convince the constituents out there, enough of them, that I can get enough phone calls or enough of them calling other folks saying, hey, listen to Senator Young, Representative Young. I've got to deal now with folk who got elected just like I did. That is the challenging part, because obviously they bring in positions and perspectives from their communities that are much, much different from the needs and hopes of my community. And so that's been the biggest thing, trying to, and then having this inequity as far as parties are concerned in the numbers here and in the state of Oklahoma. The fact is, whatever party has the number controls. In the House is 101 representatives. There are 24 Democrats. They only need 51 to pass any bill.
Right.
They got a supermajority where they can, if they want to override a veto, whatever, they got that. So it's, in the Senate, it's 48 senators, 39 Republicans, 9 Democrats. We need 25 to pass a bill. So if I had to describe us, we're really insignificant. And the best thing we can do is to have that opposing view stated and stated clearly. That's the best thing, because mm-hmm. we're not going to move them off of where they are. But in life, you need that opposing view so that people can have something to see and hear to judge by what the majority is saying. We just want an opposing view so that we can compare. And that's, I think, is our most significant job. And I don't know if we're doing it to the best of our abilities yet. And I'd like to see us do a better job of doing that.
I think this is a particularly hard time in terms of the era we're in as a country, regarding anybody paying attention to an opposing view as other than evil.
Right, right. I'm glad you said evil. And when people stop me and talk to me, because they do, I have this going for me, that most folk who talk to me know that I pastored for 30 years.
Uh-huh.
I tell them that I think some things in life occur, not right or wrong, not good or bad, but some things occur for our welfare. We don't understand that because it seems so ridiculous or so hard or so mm-hmm. hurtful that mm-hmm. we can't grasp it, you know, because mm-hmm. it's so. And I think I am very concerned about where this country is. I am very concerned about the direction this country is going in. I am very concerned about the leadership of this country. But I also know that I still believe that it is for a reason that we are in this period and in this season, and it's larger than the person that's in the White House. It's mm-hmm. larger than that.
Mm-hmm.
And this country, I like to say this country, you know, all the wars, you can talk about revolutionary, from the Revolutionary War breaking from England, Civil War, which was, you know, over slavery, but split together. The Civil Rights Movement, I think, 40s, 50s till now, was the most tumultuous period and most meaningful period in the life of this country, because it was the struggle for the soul of this country. We are in a connected struggle right now for the soul of this country.
I agree.
So, I put that across every time people talk to me, because they want to talk to me. You know, where is God? I think God right in the middle of this. I think God is saying, I want to know how you're going to suffer in Egypt. Are you going to be faithful in Egypt through all of this? Because it is for a reason that I'm carrying us through this. So I really do believe that. So, I have gotten to the point where it's difficult to hear some of the things, because I think now about my grandsons are older now. The last one, the third and youngest one, is graduating high school. But man, you're talking about when your leader talks the way that we hear, that's just not a good example. That's the biggest thing I've got, is right is not right anymore once you get past this level. You know, so like you said, and the number of folk who have committed themselves to protecting wrong instead of standing up for right, that's a bit scary.
It is.
That's a bit scary.
It is. So you are both a racial ethnic minority mm-hmm. Within the Oklahoma
Senate. Two blacks out of 48.
Right. And I would think that your theological stance with its social justice component or even emphasis to it, also puts you somewhat in a minority in terms of religious stance. I'm wondering ways that you've had maybe some opportunities to witness to being a person of faith with a very different, deeply held set of beliefs than what maybe many of your colleagues have done.
Again, you know, it's because there's only two African Americans, they don't know me, so they pretty much have studied, read up on me because they want to know. And only, so yeah, 48, only two African Americans, so it makes us a little unique in that body, in that room, which is the other thing. Now, I've sat in the room, this past session as a senator, and looked across that floor because I was against the wall so I could see the whole thing. And I'm telling you, man, it's even at my age, at 65, I'm telling you, I look out over there and I'm thinking to myself, this is still a problematic kind of thing for me to look out and not see anyone like me out of 48 folk who are the people who really make decisions concerning this whole state. That's problematic. Second thing is, when you talk about differences and how they know I'm a minister, and so I think it's a plus for me, the larger difference is rural and urban. And a lot of those rural senators, rural representatives, have a perspective that's not wrong, but it's void of what really happens in a city. They don't have the diversity to some that's changing with Hispanic in some of those rural areas, but it's not there. So they don't have diversity. Educationally, they have more control because the school districts, the superintendent, the teacher, the mayor, the police chief, all go to the same church, all go to the same place to eat. And so you know if there's a problem, if Johnny's acting up, listen, I'm going to see at McDonald's everybody I need to know to say, listen, we're working with Johnny here and we need, and so they don't quite get, even with the rates of poverty that we approve are large in those rural areas, the connection between what happens in a city, an urban area, and what happens in a rural area, I think escapes them. And so part of my responsibility I have felt since being just this first year over in the House, same thing, was helping them to understand the difference, why some bills, some legislation just will not work. And I'm going to tell you, one of the most significant ones was this gun bill. And my position was simply, because the majority were rural, shotguns in the back of their truck and guns, taking my children out, hunting, you know, learning them how to shoot. It's part of their life. What you don't get is, if you lived in an urban area, one, with the degradation of the family, you don't have those fathers who are teaching the kids how to hunt. Why would they need to hunt if living in an urban area? Listen, maybe one-third is rural, and which is a big deal. Another one-third, a little larger than that, would probably go 40% rural. The other is urban. Oklahoma City and Tulsa, in particular.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Which says a lot. You don't have that. So you don't have that. The need of a weapon is not there. I understand why farmers need weapons. You know, when I tell folks that the one bill that made me understand what I was up against in Oklahoma legislature was when they started talking about feral hogs. I had no idea what that was.
I remember we talked about that once before. Right.
To a day and a half. And I'm thinking, why are we talking about hogs?
And today it's in the New York Times.
It was. I'm just telling you. So I was not calling a hog. That was bacon I eat. And but that when you get called off the floor and there's a man and a woman, his wife and two little children, and he's saying to you, I need you to vote for this bill that will allow us to kill feral hogs at night using scopes, out of helicopters, whatever we need, because they're so damaging. Then you find they really are damaging to, and to hear the debate about that, it blew me away because we spent a day and a half. But that helped me to understand the makeup and the context of being a legislator in Oklahoma, is that there are some rulers that I've got to learn about because I'm going to vote on. So I don't know. Part of my responsibility is to help them to understand, you know, the gun bill may have been fine. You know, the rulers, you don't see any problem with that. You know, constitutional carry, we have a right to bear arms, Second Amendment, you know, all that. But you don't understand the problems that creates in an urban area where they're not hunting and they're using those guns to, purposes that create havoc. mm-hmm. in our city. And so that was the thing. And they heard that, but it was difficult for them to overcome Second Amendment and my right, Second Amendment down here, and my right to carry a weapon. And so they could not transfer what I was saying from where they were to mm-hmm. the areas that I served. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it still hurts us now.
You know, it used to be said that polarization might be really bad on the national level, but because we have so much, many more face-to-face relationships at the state level or local level, mm-hmm. polarization is not as bad. What would be your assessment of that statement today?
Wrong.
Yeah.
No. With the numbers we got, let's just share those numbers just in the state legislature. I don't think there's even a concern about bipartisanship. I don't think so.
Right.
Because they
it's not necessary.
Numbers. It's, I feel irrelevant.
Right.
Be honest mm-hmm. with you, I feel irrelevant because we have gotten to this point where those numbers are so out of whack. They don't need to come over and talk to us about something. They have the power. There's always, this is what I had learned in the House and learned in the Senate, that the numbers are the most important thing, because your party has the numbers. If you have enough numbers, you have options that can take away the rights of others in that group mm-hmm. to express themselves. Mm-hmm. There's mm-hmm. a nuclear option in the House and in mm-hmm. the Senate mm-hmm. that if the 9 Democrats wanted to do something, slow stuff down, whatever, they could. The rest of those folk could overrule us because of the numbers and make a ruling that would eliminate our ability to make any impact on anything that occurs on that floor. Now, they wouldn't want to do that because they'd have to face the news and media, but they can do that. You fuss and argue and do that, but you know in the end, you know, it's done. There is a little different relationship in Senate and House. I was in both of them. The House was a little more fighting, hollering, yelling, screaming, you know. But I got along well with both sides of the House, so yeah. But it was still a little more rough tumble in the Senate, because I looked the word up, Synax is where we get the word Senate from, and it means old men.
Right.
And I tell folks, right. I look around right. the room, I look at myself and the rest, that's what it is, a room of old men. So, old white men, matter of fact, you know.
Yeah,
so,
right.
it is interesting. There's a calmer demeanor in the Senate, and a lot of those folk I knew before I came over, so they're, you know, very kind, and I know I got friends over there, so I talk to them and all, but they are still mm-hmm. caught up in their perspectives from their districts, and people are like, well, you think they just mean and evil? No, they're not. They just can't move away from what they believe is mm-hmm. what's best mm-hmm. for the people that they represent. Mm-hmm. That's the job, mm-hmm. is to help them understand that it's larger than where they're coming from. And so that to me is the difficulty, trying to help them broaden their view mm-hmm. of the state of Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. This summer I've heard more injection of the national stuff, mm-hmm. but I've never heard that on the floor. Never heard it on the floor. It was never just brought there, which said to me something that even though Oklahoma is obviously a Republican state, it just never was brought to the floor. The names of those individuals involved was never brought to the floor. It was never injected into our conversations, our debates, our trying to move legislation. It never was. Now, I've seen more of that, and my expectation is I think things are probably going to get a little uglier this session.
We have an impeachment going on.
Right.
And there'll be reactions to the impeachment.
So I think it's going to now, that stuff that we didn't have to deal with, I think it's going to come out. And I'm really saddened by that, because I think it's going to really hinder our ability to get some things done.
Do you see any ways out of the mess? For democracy, for competing interests, for political minority rights and the like, because we appear to be headed on the other direction of democracy as mob, as in majority rules, you know, we win, you lose. It's rather than, no, we won today and we may need a different set of coalition partners tomorrow.
Right.
And so you always leave and out. And that's not where we're at.
that's not where we're at. And no, I don't. I think we've got some very difficult days. Very difficult days ahead of us. And the last election, two things jumped out at me that surprised me. One was the level of, I don't want to call it ignorance from the standpoint of lack of knowledge, but ignorance from the standpoint of really hearing and investigating mm-hmm. What people are saying mm-hmm. and where they're coming from and being mm-hmm. honest about it. Mm-hmm. To mm-hmm. be ignorant, some ignorance is not being honest. So not being honest about it, that there were somehow a lot of folks who were touched by a message that pulled them out to support people that they didn't really investigate. The second thing was, it was very surprising the level of racism that I found to still exist in this country. That keep me back on my heels a bit. Don't get me wrong, I didn't think it was gone, mm-hmm. but
right.
I did not know it was at that level that has erupted. And within that same second point is how someone can play that for their own benefit, and people don't call it what it is.
Where it actually helps them. Where it actually helps them.
So, and I'm not even talking about the international stuff. So
I know. Right.
Prior to the phone call. Forget that. Because that's some craziness. Still, this country isn't. I mean, you just think about our foreign relations. I mean, there's some crazy stuff going on. And I don't know if we realize how crazy it really is. And we won't joke about Putin. But that's some scary stuff. That is some scary. You got, this is my friend. Mm-hmm. Right. And his goal is to destroy us.
A list of friends, right?
I can't see anything other than he wants to destroy. He wants to be the man of the world, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And we placate and act like, no, it's all right. It's all right. He's not doing it. So I am very disturbed. I mean, this is very disturbing. And I think it is a struggle again. We're in the midst of a struggle for the soul and the spirit of this country. I think as tough as the civil rights movement, which continues. So you got that embedded.
Right.
Because you got another civil rights movement with the Hispanic population and all of that occurring. How are we going to respond to our southern borders? How are we going to respond to African Americans? How are we going to respond to this obviously not covert but overt racism that has been placed within the very center of our conversation about democracy? So I'm concerned. I'm concerned.
Yes, I keep calling to mind Langston Hughes' mm-hmm. poem, which he concludes that "Make America America again, the land that has not yet been but yet must be."
But yet must be. That's yeah. right. And we came so close with the election of President Obama. We came so close to the ability to open that conversation up.
Yes.
I didn't expect it to turn everything around completely, but I just thought it was. And so the swinging back of the pendulum knocked me back on my heels. I just couldn't fully grasp it again because of those two things, the ignorance mm-hmm. and the racism jumped out. And I thought, well, we're still struggling.
Right. Well, I was reminded again of Isaiah's words that people walked in darkness have seen a great light, but didn't really say how long the walking in darkness right. is going to happen.
Right.
And it certainly isn't as short as the season of Advent nor an American election cycle. You could say it that the civil rights movement has a lot of undone business.
Right.
And overcoming Jim Crow and overcoming the Civil War and overcoming the founding narratives, which included some people and excluded others. We as people of faith just have a lot we could be contributing that unfortunately I see too many people of faith.
You're absolutely right. I like what you just said is perfect because when I deal with my community, what I do see is exact. I go back to the beginning of this country, how it was established that you left out some people with the Civil War, after Civil War, Jim Crow, how it was institutionally you suppressed a whole segment of the population. And now you want to wonder why we got the problems we have is because you you made that, you created that problem by saying you can't live there because those houses are going to accumulate in value. We're going to put you over here, but those houses are not. And so these people, when they sell their home, they're going to make two times as much as they pay for it. When you sell your house, if you can sell it, you're not going to make it. So you have nothing to leave to your children. Mm-hmm. And so your children are going to start all back over again
right.
where you
With
are.
That big wealth gap.
That's problematic to me.
Reverend Dr. George Young, thanks so much for sitting down with me today on Committing Faith in Public, which you've done for many years, and look forward to your continuing contributions.
Thank you.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
It.
Uh-huh.
This has been Committing Faith in Public, a podcast from the Religion and Public Life Initiative at Phillips Theological Seminary in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Copyright PTS and Gary Peluso Verdant. The views and opinions expressed during the podcast are those of the individuals and do not necessarily reflect an official position of Phillips Theological Seminary.